All you gardeners out there, or would-be gardeners, this one's for you. And even those who like to admire flowers and our fauna. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, a co-host this evening. Yes, my privilege to announce that Tom Ritter is returning to our microphones. You've heard his voice before if you listen to WDIY. Tom is my co-host, and when I told him that we were going to be talking about gardening, he said, John, I know you don't know the difference between a pansy and a pine tree, so how about if I co-host? Tom, was that the way it went down?
Yes, John. Yeah, thank you so much for having me back, and I really look forward to this morning. We have some special guests with us. John, when you host Morning Edition on WDIY 88.1 FM, I hear your signature sign off as you enjoy your week, remember to be gentle to your neighbor. John, are you gentle to your neighbor?
I try to be. Let's put it that way.
John, you're one great guy. Again, it's being gentle. It's the way to treat one's neighbor for sure. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY 88.1 FM, Lehigh Public Radio. I'm Tom Ritter, your host this evening, and the topic is pollinators. Joining me from the Penn State Extension within Lehigh and Northampton counties are Master Gardener staff and volunteers, Brad Kunzman. Welcome, Brad.
Oh, well, thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Next is Lois Prythurch. Welcome.
Thank you for having us, Tom.
You're welcome.
And John.
And finally, we have Consuelo Almodovar. They'll all be discussing the following areas. Who are the pollinators? What is pollination? Why are pollinators important? And how do flowers attract pollinators? And much more. In addition, Brad will be sharing the benefits of becoming a master gardener, as well as how to become one with the Penn State Extension within Lehigh and Northampton counties. First, a little background about our guests. Brad Kunzman. Brad is a new master gardener and master watershed steward educator in Lehigh and Northampton counties. He has been working for the Penn State Extension for the past 10 years as a Northampton County 4-H Extension educator. He has a bachelor's degree in elementary and kindergarten education from Penn State. Over the years, he's had extensive training in topics related to horticulture and the environment. Brad lives on a mountainside farmette in Stroudsburg with his wife, Ambry. He volunteers for the Community Action Lehigh Valley in Bethlehem to support Southside Vision and Quiet Valley Living Historical Farm as period-dressed interpreters. He is fond of all the sorts of outdoor recreation and enjoy planning trips to the natural and historic sites around the country. Brad, one thing I saw in your previous bio was that you have reptiles on your farmette. What kind of reptiles do you have?
I sure do, but they're not quite the garden variety. They're a little bit more exotic, and they come from places around the world. Some specimens from Australia and Africa, and anything from snakes and lizards to turtles and tortoises.
Snakes and lizards.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, always a good time in the reptile room.
Well, thank you for sharing. Next, we have Lois Prythurch. Is a Northampton County Master Gardener since 1996. Residing in Palmer Township, she has always been interested in plants and wildlife. Each summer since 2004, she has raised and released an average of 75 monarch butterflies collected from eggs found on milkweed growing in her yard. Her yard has been certified as a backyard habitat with the National Wildlife Foundation since 1991. In 2015, she became a beekeeper and currently has two hives to help with pollination. She is on the Master Gardener Speakers Bureau giving talks about creating backyard wildlife habitats, raising monarchs, and becoming a beekeeper, and is involved in a number of community projects. Lois, with the fact that you're a beekeeper, have you ever been stung?
Oh, absolutely. It goes without saying, but they're just a minor inconvenience, kind of like a mosquito bite, and you just go on. The interesting thing about it is bees will only sting if they feel deeply threatened, because a honeybee, I should say. And if you're going into their hive and they feel threatened, they want to protect their hive. So that's why they sting, because they'll die after they sting you. So they don't want to die, and I don't want them to die. So we try to be gentle with our bees.
Oh, that is super. And I guess, can you become immune to bee stings over time?
I don't know that answer.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Know. Yeah. And then finally, we have Consuelo Almobadar. She is a Lehigh County Master Gardener for the past 14 years. She resides in South Allentown and has informal flower beds throughout the property. She gardens with wildlife in mind, having flowers in bloom from early spring until late fall. She keeps herself busy as a bee. I like that, busy as a bee. What kind of bee are we talking about there?
A little queen bumblebee.
A little queen bumblebee.
Or whatever cute bee is in season.
She's with many Master Gardener projects, such as the Lehigh Valley Flower Show, Native Plant Kit Sale. She's on the Speaker's Bureau for Children and Adults. She took lead in the statewide Master Gardener Citizenship Scientist Pollinator Preference Monitoring Program for Lehigh and Northampton counties. She also leads a pollinator demonstration garden at Burnside Plantation in Bethlehem, where pollinator-related programs are given throughout the year for children and adults. You mentioned, Consuelo, that you have an informal garden. What's the difference between an informal garden and a formal garden?
Well, my informal garden probably won't be on the cover of any garden magazine. So it's pretty wild, and like I said, I garden for wildlife in mind, so I don't care if it looks a little messy or you know, sloppy. It's not well manicured, but it surely attracts enough, you know, bees and butterflies, so that's who I'm gardening for. But I try to keep the front yard a little more tidy so that the neighbors aren't overly concerned.
So the fact that we're in May, there'll be plenty of pollinators out there pollinating your garden.
Definitely, definitely.
So let's start. Consuelo, what is pollination?
Well, pollination is a flowering plant's way of reproducing. So fertilization needs to take place. And how that's done is by moving pollen grains from the male part of the flower, the anthers, to the female part of the flower, the stigma. So that's really important because that's how it sets its fruit and develops viable seeds. And without pollination, we wouldn't get a lot of the nutritious, delicious fruits and vegetables we like to eat, seeds and nuts and berries, and a lot of other flowers that are pollinated. We get fibers and medicinal medicines from. So there's really real importance of pollination, and our little pollinators manage to do the job really well for us. So, and then also it helps to sustain a healthy ecosystem, and there's a lot of genetic biodiversity out there, and that's probably even more important. It's for all of nature, not just human beings that were, you know, that are involved with the benefits of pollination.
Wow, so pollinators are very important.
Very. Very.
Right. Lois, who are some of the pollinators that are out there?
Well, there's a wide variety of pollinators, but the most prolific are probably the insects. So the bees, the wasps, the flies, the beetles. But there's also hummingbirds are considered a pollinator because they'll go to the different flowers collecting their nectar and rub up against the pollen and transfer that from flower to flower. And along with those two are butterflies and moths. So we also have pollination going on in the evening or the night hours with the moths coming out. And bats, too, they can be pollinators. So there's another nighttime one going on. And humans can be pollinators, but we are nothing compared to the insect world in pollinating in, our plants.
So I was wondering, with regard to humans, that's interesting, with regard to how as humans do we affect pollination?
Well, if you don't have the pollinators, or if you're doing more research type stuff where you want to transfer certain pollen from one plant to another to maybe make a hybrid or a different type of flower, different color, whatever. That's more in the research lab. But if you're without pollinators, they would have to go out into the orchards or out into the fields and actually with Q-tips or whatever go from flower to flower and do the work of the insects.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. So as we're discussing pollinators, why did they actually visit flowers and plants?
Well, actually, our pollinators are visiting flowers for their own purposes. They're going there for food or for other substances. They come to visit flowers sometimes just because they're resting, just kind of flying, and they need to take a little break, or they're waiting to find a mate. There's a lot of these insects that are feeding, but they're also looking for other insects to eat. But the most important thing is that our main pollinators are actually looking for food. So they're looking for pollen and nectar, and also some of the bees collect oils and resins. So there's a lot of substances that they're getting from visiting the flowers.
So does the color of the flower affect at all?
It does. There's something called pollinator syndrome. So that kind of refers to the characteristics or traits that each flower exhibits. And so certain insects really only see specific colors. And a lot of them are the ultraviolet, the end of the spectrum there. The shape and size of the flower matters because all the pollinators are different sizes, so the length of their tongue is important, whether the flower is going to be real deep or small or tubular. For a lot of the butterflies or hummingbirds will have better access to that. There's the pollinator syndrome is all about color. The petals are, I kind of say they're like a help wanted sign or a billboard that's attracting them. I need help to move my pollen. So the petal color is attracting maybe the pinks and the purples or reds will be butterflies. Bees only see blues and purples and yellows. So there is color specific to each pollinator. Odor, so it may be a nice fragrance or it may be kind of a putrid, rancid smell that some of the flies come to. So all those things matter, and timing is real important because there's diurnal insects that are out during the day, and then they're coming to flowers that remain open during the day, whereas some are nocturnal, and then the flowers open at night. So even timing, and you know, you wonder, why do I plant spring? Why do I need summer flowers? Why do I need fall? But timing is a way that these plants, I mean, we don't really think of it that way, but there's a reason they don't all bloom at the same time, or else there wouldn't be enough pollen and nectar all season long for these different insects, because throughout the whole summer, there are different bees and butterflies that only come out during those times. So that's why it's so important to have all these different flowers blooming all season long. But mostly they're coming to look for food sources.
All right, so pollinators are very important out there in many different ways.
They are, and really that relationship between the flower and the pollinators is, you know, it just, one really can't go without the other. That's why, you know, they've co-evolved to have this relationship.
And being a beekeeper, you actually see it up close and personal, because the bees will go out to the flowers and collect the nectar, bring it in, and put it into the cells of their honeycomb. And there's other bees that stand over the honeycomb and flutter their wings to dehydrate it, and that's where honey comes from. So you're actually seeing the transformation of the nectar into honey, as well as the pollen, where they collect it in pollen sacs on their legs. So if you see a bee, they might have these big bulges on their legs with different color, maybe white, maybe...
Like bumblebees?
Bumblebees will have it. Honeybees will have it. I think most bees will have it. where they collect the pollen, and then they bring it back, and again, they store it in the honeycomb, and they use that to feed their babies. So that's where you're actually seeing it in action, right, of what the bees are doing with that.
Mm-hmm. So people, I think the most complaint or thing that I hear people say is the fear of being stung, and I think that's why a lot of people, really, when you talk about pollinators, when you bring up butterflies, they're okay, but once you start talking about bees, oh no, no, I don't want any bees in my garden. But you have to sort of help them get over the fear of being stung, because they really don't want to sting you. They actually are just really going to find food, and it just happens that we get in their way. And like Lois said, when they really feel threatened is when they really, that's their last resort, is to want to sting us. So,
and a wasp gives the bee a bad name, because the wasp is more ornery, and they'll just sting you. They're the ones that'll crawl in your soda can or eat your potato salad. Honeybees and the native bees won't bother your picnic. So it's the wasps that are giving the bees a bad name for stinging.
I see. Switching over to the plants themselves, why are native plants important?
Native plants are important because if you ask five people in the room to explain what a native plant is, you'll get a little different answer from everybody. But native plants are, some people will say they were the flowers and plants that were here before European settlers came here. So those native plants and all the pollinators have co-evolved over all those thousands and thousands of years. So they've built up this symbiotic relationship where one really can't be without the other. The what the insects are getting from native plants is so much more beneficial than non-natives or exotics, because the quality of the pollen or nectar is so much better. And then there are insects that are specialists, so they've co-evolved to, especially if you think of a butterfly, the caterpillar that feeds on that plant, the relationship, what they get from that, the kind of the chemistry of that plant, they get a lot of, they get more than just pollen and nectar. There's a lot of chemical chemistry properties that they get from that they can't get from non-natives. But natives are really beneficial because they're more adapted to your region. So that means that they're going to be able to tolerate your soil conditions better, your climate, the rainfall, temperature. So they're, over the long run, they're going to be more adaptable to your region. And that's kind of how you describe native plants. But the relationship between the insects and the plants is much better than with a non-native.
Tom, it's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. So much information already about plants and critters, and we're going to be back with much more information. So, dear listeners, stay with us. Be back in a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Glad to have you along with us this evening. I'm John Pierce. My co-host is Tom Ritter.
Thank you, John. Joining me this evening from the Penn State Extension within Lehigh and Northampton counties are Master Gardener staff and volunteers Brad Koonsman, Lois Prythurch, and Consuelo Almodovar. Brad, would you share a little bit about master gardening?
So Master Gardeners are volunteers that are trained through Penn State Extension to help with consumer horticulture. That said, our Master Gardeners, they learn about horticulture expertise through participation in a series of educational training classes conducted by university staff and faculty here at the local level. And our Master Gardeners not only learn that research-based information and sustainable horticulture practices, but they also develop awesome friendships and community partnerships, which is where they really get the community outreach going and answer questions for our local residents on the gardening hotline, speak to different groups, offer different programs, and help with a whole bunch of community and pollinator gardens throughout the Lehigh Valley and really across the country. The Master Gardener programs, not just here in the Valley, but out of almost every land-grant university in the United States.
Thank you for sharing. And what motivated you to become involved with the Penn State Extension?
So I've been with Penn State Extension for about 10 years, as you mentioned in my bio, and I've really loved the connection with the community. And the Master Gardener piece is really fascinating, especially because of the pollinators. I have a deep passion for what they do for our environment and how they help us get the food we need. And I'm an avid honey collector myself. So always a good time. And Lois has a good batch coming in Northampton County.
Oh, that's super. That's super. Well, let's revisit native plants again. And the question that comes up sometimes is how well do they grow in Pennsylvania? How well do the native plants grow, and the fact that I hear something about zones. What's a zone, and what zone are we in?
We are in zone 6. Our native plants do very well here, but the thing you have to remember is that old saying you hear, the right plant in the right place. So sometimes people will say, oh, native plants, you can put them anywhere and they'll do well, but you still need to do your homework. You have to make sure that if it wants to be a sun-loving plant, that you can't say, oh, it's native, I'll stick it in the shade and it'll do well. You still need to make sure what your site is, what your growing conditions are, your soil, sun exposure, you know, your water. So you still have to keep all that into consideration. But there are native plants that fit all those conditions. You just have to make sure you put the right ones in. And then you'll be fine. Native plants, it's not a complete put it in there and you don't have to do anything. You still have to make sure that you get them well established and water them just like you would any other plant. But maybe after the next year, once they're established, you don't really need to do anything. You don't have to worry about watering them. Most of them don't want fertilization, because if you chosen the right plant and put it in the right place, those conditions are what they want. So you don't have to try to amend the soil unless you really know that your growing conditions are bad. You may need to do a soil test first and see what you have and kind of amend it. But we have native plants that can fit mostly any kind of situation you would need. You just kind of have to do your homework a little bit before that.
So when it comes to pollination, there's a real advantage growing native plants.
Right.
And so if they're not native, what are non-native plants?
Well, that's another one where you can ask a group of people and you'll get a different answer from most of them. But non-native plants, you would think of plants that were brought here by European settlers. Or if you think of, you know, people say, oh, they're all attracted to my Japanese iris. And if that's all you have in your garden, you're still going to attract the pollinators, so they're still going to get pollen and nectar. It's just that the quality of the pollen and the nectar is not going to be the same. So a lot of non-natives are still being brought over here from Europe or Asia. There are some plants that, because they've been here so long, you would kind of say they're native just because they've been here for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they managed, you know, they're not invasive, where you can sort of manage them. And because a lot of the herbs that were brought over actually are beneficial to pollinators, too. It's just when we get a lot of really exotic plants that become invasive that we have to really watch. But because if you're gardening for pollinators, you want to give them the best. Just like when you have company over, you want to make sure you give them the best spread of food. So that's the same thing with natives. You're giving them food that has more nutritional value for them, and that's why you're gardening for them, so you can help them out. Everything you do, you want to help to create a healthy environment for them. So natives is probably what we recommend to start with first. If you have an opportunity to put in something new or replace a tree or a plant that died, consider using natives first, and you'll see in the long run you'll be much happier. So
you want to enable those pollinators to have a nice breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right, right. You're going to be the hostess with the mostest in your backyard.
Consuelo, you mentioned the right plant in the right place. Now, master gardeners have a vast knowledge of these different kinds of plants. What about the novice gardener who's just starting out or who has been doing this maybe for years but really doesn't have specific information? How does that person find out what's the right plant?
That's a very good question. And that's where master gardeners come in handy, because we have resources for that. We try throughout the year to hold workshops where we, these are programs that we talk about. There's a lot of fact sheets that we have, and we can always direct them to our website or other websites, other extensions that have the same information like that. So we can provide a wealth of information for them.
Let's give that website right now.
All right. You can find us at extension.psu.edu/master-gardeners.
Thank you, Brad. Let's continue with pollination. And what is a pollinator-friendly garden?
Well, for pollinator-friendly gardens, it's really having the native plants or the plants that are beneficial to pollinators available from the beginning of the growing season, so spring, like March, April, all the way up to the end of the growing season, like going into October. So making sure you have early flowering trees and shrubs. Things early in the spring would be witch hazel or spice bush for shrubs, dogwoods, service berries, native red buds or smaller trees, and perennials such as wild columbine, golden Alexander, wild geranium, creeping phlox, the crocuses, the violets, the snowdrops, the daffodils. Those are all early spring flowering and pollinator-friendly plants. So then it gets a little easier for the garden, because all the garden centers start opening up mid to late summer. So you can get a nice wide variety of plants during that time. And then fall gets a little tricky again, because things from the summer are dying off. They're not flowering anymore. The pollination's kind of filtering out from there. So the fall is a little bit harder again, but there's still a lot of choices available, things such as asters, goldenrods, mountain mints, and there are fall blooming witch hazels, for example. So again, to Consuelo's point, we do have fact sheets on these different things, and we have a gardening hotline that can be called and answer your question too by master gardeners.
Does it matter, Lois, with regard to how you plant your plants? Should you be planting them in bunches at all, like of the same species at all, like having two or three plants of the same? Or does it make a difference if you're planting them apart?
Absolutely. If you plant in what we call waves of the flowers, where if you have three or more of the same plants and they all come up at the same time and flower at the same time, then there's a proliferation of the flower available. And that is just like a searchlight going out to the pollinators mm-hmm. to come down here. Whereas if you just maybe had one little plant, it might not be as effective for the pollinator to mm-hmm. find that one little plant. But if you have the waves of plants mm-hmm. coming, and that's the nice thing about perennials too, where you can split them and year after year start making these big waves.
If I can just add with the pollinator friendly garden, why we say early spring and late fall, those are probably the key times that the pollinators need these plants, because we have a lot of really early spring. We actually have, I think, three or four adult butterflies that overwinter, so they're looking for early spring flowers. We have really, our native bees come out a lot sooner than a lot of the honeybees will. So there's a single queen bee, bumblebee, that overwinters all by her little lonesome all winter long. So she needs to come out early in spring and find food, because she's going to have to start her own nest and her colony. So early spring flowers are really important. And then the late fall are really important, because a lot of these insects need that pollen and nectar to store energy, because whatever life stage they're at, they're going to overwinter. And then if you think of our monarch butterflies, it's so key for them to have a food source with their, to sustain them for their migration. So we always think of, oh, the garden needs to be, you know, really all in bloom in the summer, but our pollinators want early spring, late fall is real key for them. So that's why a lot of the trees and the shrubs are probably a good source early in spring, before a lot of the, you know, herbaceous flowers come out.
Yeah. What I hear is, with regard to the pollinator friendly garden, one of the requirements I hear is actually having a bird bath and a bird feeder. And why is that important, you think?
Well, they need water sources. The first thing with the pollinator-friendly garden is really key that we have food sources. So depending on who you're trying to attract, we're talking about our pollinators. So, of course, pollen and nectar is important. But if you also want to have, you know, birds come in, you want to have bird feeders. But if you're putting in a lot of the right plants, you're going to get seeds and berries from those. So that's part of the whole pollinator-friendly garden. And different water sources are important, because even though our little birds want to take a little bath in the bird bath, our little bees and butterflies don't swim, so the depth of the bird baths are too deep. So we always say put in a big rock or something in there they can perch on. But there's also little bug baths that you can make for small insects, like making a little shallow depression in your garden and putting some sand or gravel there so they can get water from that. And it's really important for a lot of the male butterflies, because they drink from that and they get a lot of minerals that they need. And also for our little mason bees, they need water to help mix up the clay, the soil, because that's what they use to line and partition their nests. So putting a little bit of everything in there. And then the other part of that is we have to provide shelter and protection. So when you have a variation in heights and shrubs or different things that can be protection, whether it's from predators or from the weather, from rain or storms, or just places for them to sleep at night. Because if you walk around in your garden, like I do at night, you'll see that a lot of the male bees are under the leaves of certain flowers, and some of them all congregate together and they sleep there all night long, just holding on by their little jaws or their feet. So providing shelter protection is a big part of your little pollinator friendly garden.
And if you think about it, they're no different than us. We want food, we want water, we want shelter, and we want place to raise our young. That's
right,
all the
right.
insects and the wildlife want, too.
Yeah.
So if we could provide that, you're welcoming them into your yard.
And I think the one thing that I sort of didn't hit it, are host plants. And those are things that plants that our butterflies need. For some of them, they're generalists or specialists, but if it's a specialist, they need specific host plants in order to lay their eggs and for their larvae to feed on. And if you think of monarch butterflies, they can only lay their eggs on milkweed, the Asclepias family, whereas maybe a black swallowtail, there is a native plant for that. Golden Alexander or Zizia aura is the native plant, but they are generalists, so they'll use other plants within that same plant family. So if I'm sure if you have parsley, dill, or fennel in your yard, you've seen a lot of black swallowtail. So you have to make sure that you're including things like that for butterflies.
You mentioned mason bees, and I hear the word belly flop. What's that all about? The mason bees do a belly flop, something about the pollen?
Well, some of the bees will do that, leaf cutters, mason bees. So, you know, they're no dummies. They know that there's different ways that bees will get pollen. So for some of our bumblebees, they will buzz pollinate flowers so that it's almost like a salt shaker. They'll wrap their little legs around it, and it's something they do with their muscles. And so when you hear that bzzz on your plant, they're really just trying to shake loose more of the pollen. But the belly flop is just kind of going back. Honeybees and bumblebees collect pollen in their little pollen sacs, their corbicula, but a lot of the other solitary bees have scopa, so they collect dry pollen on their abdomens or their hind leg. So for them, belly flopping into the flower just sort of release. I think of when you have your pie dough and scatter flour on the table and you flop it down, all the powder flies all over. Well, that's kind of what they do to get the pollen up. So it's just another way for them to get more pollen.
Is that like a person jumping in the pool and trying to get other people wet?
Yeah, probably, yeah. It's a splash, and that's a good way to put it. But that's something of interest, and I try to sometimes when you're talking to children so they aren't so afraid of bees, if you look at these things, you'll actually be able to tell the females from the males because only the females carry the pollen, collect it, and carry it. So I tell them to either look at their legs. The females will have, I call it, little cheddar cheese on their legs.
Cheddar cheese.
Yes, because they take dry pollen and mix it with nectar and a little saliva, and then they make those little globs on their legs. And then the other ones with the dry pollen, like leaf cutters or the sweat bees, you'll see the females have fuzzy back legs or really yellow bellies. So they're the floppers. And
I think it's a really important point, the business about people not being afraid of bees. You can panic, and you could be on a ladder, let's say 10 or 12 feet above the ground, and there's a bee that starts to circle. If you panic at that point, can fall and hurt yourself badly. So,
right.
Yes. Well, it's time for us to take another break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. This evening, we are talking with some master gardeners. Actually, our co-host, Tom, is a master gardener for about 2 years now, Tom?
Yes, John. Uh-huh.
And then we have our three guests who are also master gardeners. We're going to continue this fascinating talk after this brief message.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
Thanks for tuning in to Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. I'm John Pierce, and my co-host is Tom Ritter. Tom is a master gardener, and our guests, three master gardeners. Here they are.
And they are Brad Koonsman, Lois Prythurch, and Consuela Almodovar. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we're discussing pollinators, and what are some of the problems facing pollinators today?
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot. And habitat loss probably has to be on the top. We're an ever-growing population, so we're always building, tearing down things. So loss of open space, open meadows, along farms. Farms are growing, in every bit of space they have. So a lot of the wildflowers are disappearing. pesticide use, climate change, and a lot of the introduced non-natives or exotics. So they're facing a lot of problems, and just the fact that we need to educate people about pollinators and how we can help them. So the fact that sometimes people are afraid of bees, so they're not really supportive about gardening for pollinators, so just learning a little bit more about them.
So if we decrease or eliminate the pesticides and herbicides, that would be important.
Very, very much,
absolutely.
Yes.
And another thing is identifying your enemy, and I put enemy in quotes, where you might be out in your garden or in your dill patch and looking at your parsley, and you see these caterpillars in there, and you think, oh, caterpillars are eating my parsley, and you want to kill them all. Well, that caterpillar could very well be a black swallowtail butterfly larvae. So by killing that larvae, you killed the black swallowtail. So if we want the butterflies, we want the larvae too. Mm-hmm. So just being aware of what you have in your yard and educating yourself towards those kind of things. And again, with the Master Gardeners, we're here to help you. So if you don't know what you're dealing with, we can help you with that. We can suggest maybe non-chemical methods to get rid of a insect problem. So things such as that Master Gardeners are here to help you with.
Super. Thinking about programs, I hear that there's a pollinator garden certification program. What is that all about?
Well, that is a program we have available that helps encourage homeowners to welcome pollinators into their space. And we actually have a whole series of information on the pollinator garden. It gives you information on what kind of plants you need to provide. And there's an application form that they go through, and we can help them by talking them through what steps they need to follow. And it's basically, like Lois had said before, it's providing food sources for the pollinators, water sources, shelter and protection, and places where they can either find nesting sites or host plants. So encourage them to plant from early spring to late fall. So we can talk them through that, or we have all that information available on the website, or they can either come to the extensions and we can help them out with that a little bit more if they need to. But even if they have a small area, starting with containers or hanging plants, just to help, anything is better than doing nothing. But we can help educate them on how to certify their garden, or even sometimes school gardens or church groups or a community park, just anywhere where we can start providing corridors for all these pollinators, so that they don't have to go very far to find their food sources.
And a wonderful example of a pollinator garden that Consuelo actually runs is over at the Burnside Plantation in Bethlehem. So there's programs all throughout the summer,
right,
explaining about what we're doing there and what plants are there, and you can get up close and personal to the pollinators.
Right. So it's there all year round. So it's open to the public and people can come in. We try to have signage that helps explain what some of the plants are, and we have our pollinator certification sign there so people can see it, and then they can say, I want one of those in my backyard. So people can apply for this, and they'll be certified, and they will get their little star on a map that's all throughout the state. And if they really want to go the extra mile, then for a small fee, then they can pay to have a sign, a garden sign, which I understand you recently received. So
Yes. I think it was through York County that I received it. And I guess that's the county that's basically pretty much...
Yeah, the program's housed out of York County, but spread across the state's 67 counties.
Right.
I see. Consuelo, about Burnside Plantation, how would folks get in touch with them to know what programs you offer? Would just Burnside Plantation in the computer?
Well, Burnside, we really have a nice partnership with them, and they do post all our events on their website, but also they would definitely find all that on our Lehigh County, Northampton County extension, our website.
Okay,
all that information.
Let's repeat that website.
And you can link to that through the state website, is extension.psu.edu/master-gardener.
And there's also the website for public to learn more about pollinators. What's that website?
That is ento.psu.edu. There you can find all kinds of information about pollinators, how to identify them, what plants to put in the ground, and that's where we house all the application information to become a pollinator garden certified owner.
Yeah, if they would click onto the Center for Pollinator Research, and then there's just one link after another of all kinds of information. And then we always encourage them, if even if they look at that and they're sort of like, woo, that's a little overwhelming for them, then they can always call us, you know, can you explain this, or you know, what do we need to do to meet this part of the requirements? So talk them through it.
So we're talking about pollinators and we're talking about flowers. Let's just go around the table, and if you could each share with me maybe your favorite flower and why you grow that flower.
For me, it's the milkweed, and I'm a big proponent of monarch butterflies. So no milkweed, no monarchs. So I raise them from eggs. And
I understand the monarch butterfly population is in trouble
these days. It is. It's crashing.
Because of not enough milkweed?
Correct. Yeah, because they migrate down to Mexico or the southern states in the late fall. And then when they're coming back, the next generation's coming back, they need that milkweed to lay their eggs and continue their progression north. So with the farming, the way it's going, it's more industrial farming. So all the like ditches and things like that, which used to grow milkweed, they're disappearing. So the monarchs coming north are losing places to lay their eggs.
Yeah, and that's where pesticides too come into play. And
Absolutely. Unfortunately,
if you're spraying to kill one thing, you're going to spray to kill everything. And then unfortunately, those larvae, if they do find milkweed, are eating that plant that's been, you know, sprayed or near where there's been spraying.
So Consuela, what's your favorite flower?
I don't have a favorite. I love them all, but I will have to say I do love milkweed, and I especially love common milkweed, which probably gets the worst, the bad rap. But it just the fragrance of that is, it and it there's almost every kind of pollinator on it at any time of the day. I come home from work late at night, usually about 12 o'clock at night, and you will see moths covering those. It really is like, if you plant it, they will come. And then, you know, then
Absolutely. The plus
is that you have the monarch caterpillars. But I pretty much love it all, because throughout the season, whatever's in bloom, early spring flowers, your geraniums, your there's so many. It's like
there's a lot.
Every other day is my favorite. So
I'm a big fan of goldenrod. I love the flowing fields
of goldenrod,
and the bees love it. But pretty much all of our pollinators will flock to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good host plant for pretty much all of them. And I like the aroma when you're walking through a field that it gives off. And I'm one to hike a lot, so you can find a lot of goldenrod as you're hiking, either on edges or big fields and some grassy meadows, it'll pop up.
Yeah. I love the morning glory. I just love the heavenly blue that you see with the morning glory.
Right.
Yeah.
And you see hummingbirds coming by, and I love hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
So they like colors. I hear they love red, orange,
and
like a really pretty blue. Some people refer to the morning glory as a weed. I take a little offense to that. You know, I really think it's a beautiful flower. It's nothing better than see a morning glory opening up in the morning and then closing once it gets a little cloudy in the afternoon.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a great flower to wake up to.
Mm-hmm. Tom, how about the definition of a weed that I heard once upon a time? Anything you don't want in your garden.
That's right.
Okay.
But actually, there are so many weeds you do want in your garden. You know, your your dandelion, your clovers, they're really good bee sources. So some of the weeds I'll take.
Absolutely.
So Brad, let's switch gears. And how does one become a master gardener?
Well, master gardener programming is run through the extension office in the county you live in. So Penn State Extension has 67 different extension offices across the state. Here in the Lehigh Valley, we have one in Northampton County near the Graysdale Retirement Home and one in Lehigh County right near Dorney Park. What an individual is to do is to fill out an application. It gets reviewed by our development committee. And if you're selected, you go through 40 hours of training. And no, a lot, right?
Wow. That is a lot.
But, you know, we want our volunteers to be as educated as they can be to help folks. After that 40 hours of training, individuals need to test out with about an 80% score, 80% or above. And then in order to become fully certified as a master gardener, they need to attain 50 hours of volunteer time. Once they attain that 50 hours of volunteer time, and that can be through anything we do in the master gardener program, which we'll touch on a little bit later, they are able to keep their status by giving back 20 hours each year of volunteer time and maintaining about 10 hours of continuing education, just to make sure they're up to date with the most current information when it comes to gardening, taking care of our pollinators, or those emergencies that pop up, like the spotted lanternfly.
Wow. Wow. I know that just looking at everyone here, from what I added up your years, but a total combined number of years that you've had with the Penn State Extension, over 45 years. So we have a lot of experience here with everyone.
Tom, I'd like to ask a question. I'm just curious. Do you remember a really difficult question from the final test to be a master gardener?
I'll pitch that one to our master gardeners here.
I took the test 20-some years ago. I don't even remember it.
So the thing with me is as much as I love being a master gardener, I really had no background. I didn't grow up on, you know, my grandmother's farm. I didn't have people say, oh, I gardened with my parents since I'm knee-high to a grasshopper, but I didn't have any of that. And I would have to say my Girl Scout years were what really threw me out into nature. And I've had more love of nature, and I've always loved flowers for whatever reason. I guess I'm a true flower child.
Well, hooray for the Girl Scouts then.
Right. And so a lot of this is all what I'm learning as an adult, and with working with the pollinator garden, my love of bees and butterflies is kind of, you know, something new that is of interest to me. So,
and I think a big part of it too is, for a master gardener, is you don't have to know everything about everything. We certainly don't individually,
right.
But it's that thirst for knowledge, and it's wanting to share that knowledge with others.
Right.
So the volunteer aspect is so key to go out and inform the public of things and to share what we know and to make a better
right.
environment for us.
So all these areas that I knew nothing about, you're always learning. You know, mm-hmm. you have an opportunity to learn and then, share amongst each other, and then definitely with the public. So
Brad, what type of volunteer projects do master gardeners work on?
Well, speaking of sharing that information, there's a lot of public education that goes into being a master gardener. We have on our website a speakers bureau of all different talks that are offered by our local master gardeners, and they are offered to both private, nonprofit, public organizations, to really educate people about various different topics, anything from backyard vegetable gardening to pollinator gardening to even amending your soil and making it better. We can get very specific with those different talks. But we also have a couple committees that work on some really, really cool workshops for the public. We have the workshops for the home gardener that can touch on anything from African violets and orchids all the way to planting your native plants in the right place. Back a couple months ago, we had the Spring Garden Series, and that's a spattering of programs that really gets you ignited for spring and offers anything from pruning to water gardening to starting your seeds in preparation for your gardens in the summer. You'll find our master gardeners out at a lot of different community events as well. They like to educate with different displays at fairs and schools, and even down here where WDIY is, the community festivals that are offered. We're trying to teach people the most we can. Our fundraising efforts, although they're there to support the program, they're really geared at educating the public as well. We had a native plant sale in the spring, and that's really to promote these pollinators, really get people to get awesome plants in their yard and really support the pollinators in their endeavors for keeping fruits and vegetables and our ecosystems good. A great part about being a master gardener as well is being able to socialize with a bunch of other people with similar knowledge as you. So you get to go on field trips and different garden tours and participate in our fun annual banquet, which here in the Valley is called the Groundhog Party because it's right Groundhog Party. We celebrate around Punxsutawney Phil and all the great things, whether winter's going to last a little longer or spring is arriving early. So that said, how you can find us here in the Lehigh Valley, best way to get in touch with our master gardeners is through our garden hotline, and that's at the Lehigh office, reached by calling 610-391-9840. Again, the Lehigh office, 610-391-9840, and the Northampton office at 610-813-6613. Again, the Northampton office at 610-813-6613.
Oh, it's a little remiss, John. What's your favorite flower?
Oh, my favorite flower has to be the pansy. That doesn't have anything to do with our topic today, does it? I haven't heard anyone mention the pansy here.
Oh.
No, the pansies are good, too.
I just love the little face that they have on them. And it comes from the French word penser, which means thought. So it does look as if there's a little face on them. That's why I love pansies, even though I can't tell the difference between them and pine trees. You understand?
I understand.
Uh-oh.
Listen, Tom, you have done such a wonderful job co-hosting with me. Thank you very much. It's time for us to call it a night here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We thank our listeners for tuning in. Thanks to Neil Heaver for engineering for us this evening. He's our Director of Operations here at WDIY. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.